Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
Neil just selected a chip with the most, like, thought and grace I've ever seen anybody deploy to select a chip.
It was the physical hand gesture version of, I don't mind if I do. Hello and welcome to Witch Please, a fortnightly podcast about the Harry Potter world. I'm Hannah McGregor.
I'm Marcel Cosman.
And I'm Neil Barnholden.
After a short holiday hiatus, we're sitting down in the same damn room to bring you our promised Q&A minisode follow-up to Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And Marcel is poking me very hard.
Gentle one-finger touch. That's right, witches. We went a little long on the last episode, so we're back to answer. We actually went so long that Neil had to leave. Anyway, so we went a little long in the last episode, so we are back to answer the questions that you asked us using the Fantastic Asks hashtag in a single episode-long segment we're calling Fantastic Asks and Where to Find Them.
Nope.
Fantastic Asks and Where to Ask Them.
It's the world's greatest segment name. Don't fuck it up.
It's a very good segment name. You did a really good job. 10 out of 10.
Witch, please, make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know. Oh, oh. Witch, please, make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know.
Topic 1. Obscuri. Or obscuri, depending on Latin or Greek.
I'm having a surprisingly hard time pronouncing all of the words from this movie, considering that it was a movie, so I encountered them all said for the first time. And yet, having written them down now, I have no idea how to say any of them. So
I still need to think about Scamander or Scamander every time. I'm always wrong, though.
You don't do enough impressions of actors in your head. You have to do more impressions.
You're an interesting man, Mr. Scamander.
So it's
Scamander.
I'm really phlegmy.
Oh, this is off to a roaring start. So our first question from Kristen Morin is, if wizarding authorities know about obscurials, and knowing how volatile teenagers are in general, isn't enacting the decree for the reasonable restriction of underage sorcery a pretty risky move? isn't it? It's almost like if people know that abstinence-based sexual health education leads to higher rates of STIs in pregnancy, isn't enacting that as a policy in post-secondary education a pretty risky move?
I would like to congratulate the question asker for formulating an exceptionally well-phrased question that answers itself. Bravo, Kristen Warren. Bravo.
I really like how much people are using this movie and the new information that it provides us with to sort of reread and complicate stuff that they know from the original series. Mm-hmm. On January 1st, on New Year's Day, Marcel and I watched the first half of the Lord of the Rings trilogy extended edition. We got through the first disc of the second movie. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the Hobbit movies, which I haven't seen since I saw them all in theaters because I make great life choices and spend my money wisely. And how little any of those movies added to the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Like, they didn't... They gave you no... Like, it was... Just
get it together, Colin.
It was just like the worst kind of foreshadowing where like a character would look off into the distance and be like, something evil is coming, but you need to wait a book or two.
No, I think we can all agree that like we wouldn't possibly have known that Sauron?
Scamander.
Sauron. Was evil if it hadn't been for that really helpful scene of the necromancer flashing into Sauron's eye back and forth like at least 112 minutes. At least. Because just when you're like, they're going to stop now, it keeps going. Never. Just in case you didn't get it. I don't think I would have completely understood the Lord of the Rings trilogy if it hadn't been for that very helpful bit of explanation.
Do you think anyone watching the movie had any moment where they went, oh, this is Lord of the Rings. Oh, that's him. That's the guy.
I just got it. Yeah. So this, like, as a prequel, Fantastic Beasts is so much more interesting because it's not about exactly the same characters and it isn't as heavy-handedly foreshadowing the books that we already know, but it's actually providing us with more new interesting tidbits of information. And mm-hmm. I think this is one of them. Like, we now have the context to know what can happen to young witches and wizards when they are not allowed to practice their magic, and so we have a better sense both like of maybe the really difficult decision the wizarding world needs to make around like, it's really urgent that we keep our young people safe because they are vulnerable when they are young. They are vulnerable to muggles who can be hateful and abusive. We see that in this movie. We see it in the original trilogy. Let's just call it. I mean, I think we can all agree. We see it there as well. But to then get that sense that like, there's also risks involved in telling people not to do magic and that it like might not be the best decision to have made, but also kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I guess if we think about magic as a tool or an ability and not as an identity, mm-hmm. or I might rephrase this when I get to the end of my sentence.
Classic Marcel, always bringing identity politics into it.
Typical.
So if we think of it in terms of like a craft or a skill or something that you're learning how to do, I guess in some senses it does kind of make sense. So you know how proponents of like quality sex education will compare learning about sexual health and whatnot with driving a car, and so they'll make the argument that you don't just like put a person in a car with the keys and be like, driving is dangerous, you shouldn't drive. Drive now, but safely. Like, I wonder if maybe we might similarly think about magic in a similar way. Like, students, everybody knows that they're going to do it, so they have a reasonable restriction. It's not a, like, if you do it, you go to Azkaban. It's like, you're really not supposed to do it. Maybe that's why the students are at Hogwarts for so many months of the year. Because can you imagine what it would be like to parent teenagers when they're not allowed to do magic for more than 2 months, it would be exhausting. Like, when I think of what a pain in the ass I was as a teenager, and I was like, fuck you, Mom, I can do whatever I want.
I think it's interesting, though, as Kristen Morin points out, that that does seem inconsistent, but plausibly inconsistent. I mean, it's the kind of inconsistency that you do encounter in the real world. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that maybe it's because if you imagine that the reason that youths with magical abilities are taught how to use them is to avoid obscurials existing, then you can think of the reasonable restriction of underage sorcery as just being a further attempt to kind of, I don't know, to solidify the sort of formalness of that education. So there is no informal wizarding education. There is no legal informal wizarding education, which is interesting because I think this question is a really good one because it points towards the fact that that's not really an adequate solution to it. There's a problem of obscurials which happens, and maybe there is not really an adequate solution in this universe for what to do about that, which I do think is extremely realistic. I mean, that's really true. That's not anything you can think of that as an analogy for. There's no thing that you can do, just pass a law and there you go.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's really interesting because what you have been describing, Neil, reminds me of the question that so many people ask us constantly, which is about the pre-Hogwarts education, which, like, J.K. Rowling at some point said it's up to parents to do that. And I think we all agree that that's outrageous. but what is suddenly making sense to me about that is if there was a more formalized, if there was a more formalized education system, then maybe the restriction would apply to those students as well. And it would be a lot harder to control 11 and younger and prevent them from doing magic than it is from, like, you know, tweens and teens. Mm-hmm. You know, you, like, get stuff. You can, like, have a reasonable conversation with a person and say, like, please don't hex people. Yeah. But then I remembered that you can have different laws for different age groups, which they already do, because the reasonable restriction only applies to you once you turn 11, and they could just have a different Okay, I take it all back.
I mean, I'm thinking of the way that the reasonable restriction all of a sudden, like, when Harry does things magical by accident when he is young, before he turns 11, that is fine. Those accidents are acceptable. It's once he is considered, according to the wizarding world, to be old enough to be receiving the education that will allow him to control that, that it is no longer acceptable. And so it's like you're mature enough to make decisions. And that has parallels in how we think about law today as well. And so when you're thinking about obscurials, you're thinking about protecting children who are under 11, who not only don't have control, but who can't be expected to have control. Mm-hmm. And the very, like, 11 then becomes the age not only that you're old enough to control yourself, but that maybe that your magic has developed enough that controlling it will not cause you long-term damage. Mm-hmm. And so, like, to try to control magic when younger is actually damaging, whereas trying, like, you hit a certain point of maturity where you can actually start to, like, voluntarily not do it and it's not going to break you in any way.
Do we think that the reasonable restriction of underage sorcery is the legal entity that gives the formal magic education system its legitimacy at all?
Whoa!
Because if it wasn't for that, then you could learn magic in any number of other ways.
Mm-hmm. Great question, Neil.
But that like the formal magical education system, which is obviously profoundly like in bed with the government, which is synonymous to law enforcement in the wizarding world that we're familiar with, is all about this sort of wizarding worldwide strategy of keeping yourselves hidden from muggles. And so, yes, you can imagine a world in which wizards would be able to educate themselves, in which maybe wizards did educate themselves, and learned different traditions and learned more idiosyncratic, culturally specific versions of magic, but that is inherently less controllable, and that uncontrollable versions of magic are what puts wizards at risk. Mm-hmm. I feel as with so many things in the Harry Potter world that I'm at, like, at the edge of an analogy right now. It's like, it doesn't map perfectly onto anything. Yeah. It's just like that general attitude of like, you are somewhat, in some way, what you are is inherently risky. And so you must learn how to control it. So this sort of segues us into probably the number one most frequently asked question on the Fantastic Asks hashtag, which was, knowing what we now know about Obscurials, was Ariana Dumbledore an Obscurial?
I don't have an answer to this, but when we were talking about the idea that you age into a sorcery restriction, I was thinking about siblings, actually. You could have situations where you have multiple people in the same family who are at all possible stages of the development of a magic user. If we're thinking about the idea of an obscurial, it becomes a matter of cruelty, basically. To allow an obscurial to develop in a family where one of their siblings does have magical powers and the use of them.
So obscurials are caused by, like, an intense trauma of some variety that forces the child to repress their magic, right?
That's the impression that the film gives us, yeah. Right? That, like, it's not super clear if trauma is the only thing, mm-hmm. or if it's, like, ongoing repression or what. So, So if Ariana Dumbledore was an obscurial, that would definitely make an argument for it to be related to trauma and not just, like, living in secret.
Yeah, and we see two other people, one of whom is being, like, horrifically abused, mm-hmm. and the other, we don't see the other one, but the other one referenced by Newt is a girl who was imprisoned. Mm-hmm. So those all suggest sort of major traumatic childhood events, mm-hmm. in which the practice of magic, the sort of unintentional childhood practice of magic, in some way leads to that child being abused. Mm-hmm. And this is, like, that's the story we have of Ariana Dumbledore, right? That she practiced some magic when very young. Do we know how old she was?
I think she was 12 when she died.
Yeah. So we know that it was sometime before that, mm-hmm. that she, like, practiced some magic and some boys saw her and they wanted her to show them how to do it. And something terrible was done to her. And then from then on, she had to be kept at home. Mm-hmm. I see nothing wrong with that mm-hmm. reading. Mm-hmm. I think it makes a lot of sense. I think, like, we know that in some way Grindelwald found out about the existence of obscurials and became obsessed with them. Mm-hmm. And the setting of Fantastic Beasts is after that time that Grindelwald and Dumbledore spent together. And so it's mm-hmm. after Grindelwald would have known Ariana and seen what happened to her. Mm-hmm. If he saw Ariana's obscurus released and saw it kill people, he would know the power of them. Mm-hmm. And so it would make sense that he then is aware of that as a form of dark magic and is seeking it out elsewhere. I think it ties together a lot of narrative threads, and that makes it a good theory.
Yeah.
At some point, J.K. Rowling will come along and tell us if we're right or wrong.
Like, the thing that I find so outrageous is the idea that she might come along and be like, no. When it's so very obviously the thing that makes the most sense, uh-huh. not unlike the fact that Sirius Black and Remus Lupin were obviously in love with each other.
Which please, make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know. Which please, make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know.
Topic 2. Legilimens. Ms. Megan asks, I'm curious about the conversation around consent, privacy, and legilimency, especially in regards to Quinny. So we can also add in Angry Care Bear's question, what are the ethics of mind reading when you're magically wired that way and it's a sixth sense akin to sight?
It was really interesting to me to see such a different representation of legilimency. Probably not. Because what we've seen before is, we know Voldemort's a powerful legilimens and Snape is. And so it seems to be something that's associated with not only with dark wizardry, but with aggression and violence and a refusal to respect people's personal boundaries. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be represented predominantly as something done intentionally and aggressively. Mm-hmm. And we see a really different version of it in Quinny, mm-hmm. that she does it unintentionally, that she does not respond to knowing what people think with any anger or aggression. Mm-hmm. She doesn't use it against people. We don't know if it's something she could control if she wanted to. She claims that she cannot control it. Mm-hmm. And therefore has turned into the kind of person who can just live with that knowledge, which is probably kind of horrifying and overwhelming to know what people are thinking about you every time they meet you. There's that joke where she says, like, oh, it's okay, honey. People always think that when they first see me. But, like, that had to have taken some work to get to the point of that being okay instead of that being horrifying. But I don't know what the larger implications are for us around this idea of a sort of non-aggressive, non-violent form of mind reading. Thank you. That is being positioned as acceptable because an acceptable character is doing it.
I do feel like a lot of this question goes to the specifics of this portrayal of mind reading, because I feel like it is really key whether she is trying to read minds or not, or whether minds are just legible to her. Mm-hmm. Right. I find it to be a really unique portrayal of mind reading for that reason. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if something is legible to you that is about a person who believes it to not be legible, mm-hmm. to be a secret, if that is the case, if we've accurately described how Queenie works, then, I mean, her only ethical choice is to be the kind of person that she is. Yeah. But I don't know how that goes to the ethics of it in the first place. Yeah. I mean, I think she behaves as an ethical person if that is the situation that she's in. Mm-hmm. If she has the choice not to, though, I don't know if that's true anymore.
I think that a key component to what makes Queenie's behavior ethical is the fact that she is open about the fact that she is a Legilimens. It doesn't necessarily do anything to make the people around her feel better. If anything, it probably would make them feel more ill at ease, knowing that she could be reading their mind at any time. But I do think that that is the more ethical choice. Like ignorance is bliss isn't a thing that you can apply when somebody can read your mind. That's not cool. So I think that's worth considering, but I don't have an easy answer for it.
I also wonder what it is that Queenie can read. Mm-hmm. Can she read surface conscious thoughts? Or can she read thoughts to a level that would be things that are unknown to the person thinking them? Mm-hmm. It doesn't totally resolve the issue, but I feel like those are very different things. Like, if she can just... If what she has is a sort of magical version of being able to, I don't know, read faces really well, mm-hmm. that seems very different than being able to, you know, perceive anything that someone is trying to conceal even from themselves, which is how other fictional mind readers are portrayed, certainly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not clear to me from the movie which one is at play there.
The impression that I got from the movie is that she's only reading people's surface thoughts, because, like, she knows, like, when she meets Jacob, she knows his first thoughts about her. She knows what he wants from dinner. She knows that he's super hungry. Later on, she knows that one of her coworkers is sleeping with somebody else. She only knows about Newt's relationship with Lita Lestrange because she asked him about the photo. Mm-hmm. And so he obviously then thinks stuff about her and that she can read. But we know from Snape and Voldemort that you can, if you work deliberately, you can take much deeper memories from people, including ones that they have been trying to repress. And so that suggests to us that there's just this surface level of information that she's just receiving whether she wants it or not, and that she basically treats that stuff as conversation, as like part of just how she interacts with other people. But we see no evidence of her making an active effort to retrieve any information that isn't like what's right on the tip of people's minds. That kind of privacy is really complex, because you're right. If it's just a kind of reading, then it's like, am I invading people's privacy if I'm particularly good at reading body language? You know, and is what she's doing unethical when maybe it's the equivalent of asking somebody how they're doing and they go, I'm fine. And you're like, right. Is it unethical to be like, no, you're not. Like, then that just becomes a matter of social, like, interpersonal dynamics.
I always have this question about people who have sort of powers that are always active. Do you think that at some point in her life, Queenie became able to read minds? Or do you think she's always been able to read minds?
Doesn't she say that she's... Am I just making this up? I thought that she says it's just something she's always been able to do.
Well, follow up to that. If that's true, do you think she understands what it's like to be people who can't read minds?
No.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I do feel that that's a relevant ethical point to bring in, that she's not a person who couldn't read minds and then suddenly could. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If to her that's always been a part of human interaction, then I would say she's behaving quite ethically by telling people that that's the case, and also by introducing into spoken conversation what people are thinking.
Mm-hmm. That information becomes something everybody in the room has, not just her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by maintaining really solid personal boundaries about the fact that what other people think of her is not on her, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's other people's...
Yeah.
What other people think of you is their right to think of you, no matter how gross it may actually be. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, not gross and flattering sometimes. Who knows?
Maybe Jacob was just thinking, gosh, she's pretty.
Yeah. But she tells him not to worry.
Because it's embarrassing for somebody to know you think they're pretty. I know. Possible.
Bless your heart, Hannah.
Which, please, make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know. Which, please, make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
Topic 3, Credence and Grindelwald.
Team Hobby Horse asks, do you think that Credence's fate wasn't given the weight it should have? Even our protagonists never talked about him again.
I remember feeling really surprised that he dies and feeling really, I remember feeling really agonized that's just done with And for me, that was part of the weakness of the plot. This, like, one of the characters who I felt the most attachment to just, like, gets literally blown away. Mm-hmm. And then everybody's good. And that didn't... I am able to suspend disbelief for the concept of Obscurials in the first place. I am not able to suspend my disbelief for shoddy storytelling.
Yeah, I mean... We watched this child who both Newt and Tina in particular were like, like, just agonized over his fate. And then in the next scene, they're like, we got some other problems to solve. Like, they never mention him again. They're not visibly grieving. They're not even particularly visibly shaken. And I suspect that that is just bad storytelling. Mm-hmm. That I kind of don't buy that these characters wouldn't, like, go home and struggle with what just happened. Maybe we'll see that in the next movies. Like, maybe we'll see some longer term consequences of this, of what they witnessed.
I also thought it was strange that they set up the character arc of Newt still being upset over the previous Obscurial that he met and couldn't save. Mm-hmm. And then though he seems to be this very empathetic character, seems really undisturbed by this horrible, horrible thing that happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I agree. I don't think it was given the weight that it should have been. No.
Mm-hmm. PewterWolf13 wants to know if we believe Grindelwald is actually gay or bi, or if he is manipulating the emotions of those around him. This emerged from a larger conversation we were having about whether or not Grindelwald is actually a canonically gay character, or if what we're seeing is just Grindelwald being a manipulative character.
Can it be both?
No.
I have some terrible news for you. Not all of the evil people in the world are heterosexual.
That doesn't sound right.
I think that it makes him a much more interesting character if it's both. Mm. I think it makes him a much more well thought out and interesting and three-dimensional character if he is evil irrespective of his sexuality, mm-hmm. but uses his sexuality as one of his many other tools to get what he wants, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we see this with heterosexual villains all the time, so I don't know why we couldn't necessarily see it with a queer villain.
Yeah, I also really wouldn't want to think of a character as shamming, like, being gay or bi in order to manipulate people for their evil ends. I think that mm-hmm. sort of associates sexuality with like a kind of weaponized choice for evil of something, which I know is not what the story would be saying, but I don't think that's really a great place to go with one of the few characters in this entire universe who, you know, if not explicitly canonically, is like pretty much a lock.
Yeah. Yeah. I do prefer also to read him as gay and also a villain, and those just being two things that are true about him at the same time, rather than, using his villainy as a way to question his queerness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, which, you know, which doesn't mean that he's not manipulative. It doesn't mean that he's not aware of the power he has over a kid like Credence and mm-hmm. is willing to use that power to get what he wants. Mm-hmm. It just means that willingness to manipulate him in that way does not then mean that his queerness isn't real.
Right. I think that this kind of question also raises the issue of, like, how we even define sexuality in the first place. Like I think many of us remain hung up on the idea that, like, sexuality and identity are necessarily intertwined mm-hmm. when, like, there are people who self-identify as queer who never practice queer sexuality, right? There are men who identify as gay men who never have sex with other men. That doesn't make them any less gay. They're still entitled to that identity. But then there are also men who mm-hmm. have sex with other men who do not identify as gay, right? So I guess what I'm saying is that sexuality and identity are slippery, slippery slopes. No, not slopes. Are slippery, slippery concepts.
Yeah.
Not slopes.
And it's only getting worse. You heard it here first.
Oh, shit.
Sexuality and identity.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry, everybody. Anyway, they're super slippery concepts. And I think that it's okay to not be definitive about everything.
So on that topic, By Shakespeare is wondering if Grindelwald's manipulation of a boy in this movie is supposed to give us a view of his relationship with Dumbledore before. So what can we learn? Can we learn anything more about Grindelwald and Dumbledore via watching Grindelwald's relationship with Credence?
I'm so hesitant to posit an answer because I know that J.K. Rowling is just going to show up and be wrong. And that's fine.
So give a better answer.
So my better answer than J.K. Rowling's, than the answer I'm anticipating from J.K. Rowling, is that it is necessarily different because Grindelwald and Dumbledore were the same age.
Very close.
Very close in age. They were peers in a completely different way. Like Grindelwald / Graves' relationship with Credence was necessarily manipulative because Credence was ostensibly a child and he was a kind of mentor figure to him, or a parental figure. And he deliberately allowed Credence to confuse or to be confused about whether or not he was loved as a child or as a partner or as a peer. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that necessarily has to be different. So I'm not saying that Grindelwald wasn't a douchebag in his relationship with Dumbledore, mm-hmm. but I think it necessarily has to be different because of the way in which age can entail power dynamics.
Yeah.
Which please make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know. Oh, oh. Which please make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know.
Topic 4, representation.
So PewterWolf13 would like us to chat a bit more about race. Mainly Madame Pickery, Madame Yajo, and the Tumblr Ho-Ha, please. So for some context for listeners, at least as far as the context that I have, is that the revelation that happened on Tumblr that Madame Yajo means Asia. And so essentially that Rowling named the only Asian character and the representative of all of Asian Wizarding Society, which for one thing is like, why would Asia have one Wizarding Society, but also named that woman Madame Asia. Which, when it came out on Tumblr, a bunch of people were like, oh, that can't possibly be true. That must just be like Tumblr being nitpicky. And then somebody checked the published screenplay, mm-hmm. and there it was. Mm-hmm. So what do you folks think about that choice that Rowling made?
Maybe a useful way to respond to this request would be to sort of build off of the things that we talked about in the last episode. So Neil had pointed out the stereotype squad. And how, what like a problematic representation of cosmopolitanism that was. Hannah had talked about how, like, essentially what this means is that you are presuming a white audience and you are attempting to make diversity and representation legible to a white audience, and how that's problematic. We talked with a handful of our listeners about Madame Yajo and how her name means Asia. And even in those conversations, there were still people in, like, people participating in those conversations with us who were like, but if it's not, like, it might just be like people misinterpreting, like, that those kinds of conversations were still happening.
Yeah.
Maybe the way to move forward with this conversation is for all of us to do more listening to what the people directly implicated in those kinds of racisms are saying, and do less talking amongst ourselves. I don't want to sound like an asshole, but I think these conversations have been had, and have been had very well by other people. And maybe we'll put some links up to those conversations instead of trying to rehash what other people have said.
I agree that watching people's response and watching how many people were rushing to assume it was a misunderstanding, and to give Rowling the benefit of the doubt, was, it reminded me of the Tilda Swinton Margaret Cho debacle, where because Tilda Swinton went to Margaret Cho and very nicely asked her to explain how race works, and then Margaret Cho after the fact was like, that was a fucking nightmare of a conversation. And then everybody was like, how dare you? You're being such a bitch. Tilda Swinton was so nice. It's that sort of white people constantly deserve the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. which in the context of white supremacy is not the case.
It's people insisting that white people deserve the very benefit of the doubt that white people refuse to give to the non-white people who are like, what you just did was not okay.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention, because this is something that I've figured out over the years, but I'm the kind of person who, like, I get it.
Laughs at a funeral?
Yeah. I'm the kind of person who, like, I would rather believe that there is less racism in the world than there is, and various problematic things. The problem with that is that it is a privilege to be able to say that. Like, to give the benefit of the doubt is a privilege itself. And I think I understand often where people come from, because you hope that it's a misunderstanding, or you hope that there's an explanation, because you would rather that there is less racism, mm-hmm. right? That would be like one incident where it somehow didn't turn out that way. But that's such a kind of privileged and delusional way to live. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sharing this because, like, I do sometimes still think this way, and I used to think this way a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think that really listening to other people, particularly people from the community that's being referenced, is really, really important in this case. And, like, just believe people. Like, if someone says, I found that racist, they did. Like, nobody lies about that. Like, there's no possible reason to do that. So that's just, like, my, I don't know. It's been a long time since I figured that out, and I still don't do it very well, but there you go.
I would also like to add, I similarly do this too, Neil, and a strategy that I have found really useful for not contributing to other people's oppression when I want to give the potential oppressor the benefit of the doubt is I just shh.
Yeah.
Just shh and see what happens. If it turns out that the white person did indeed make an error that was completely misinterpreted, I promise you, you will hear about it. I promise. No, at no point in time has a white person ever not been given exactly as much credit as they deserved.
You're saying that a white person has never been quietly exonerated of racism? Is that what you're saying?
Okay. Runal Waslib wants to know, regarding anti-blackness, how fucked is it that black characters and lack of trial executions are linked multiple times? It's super fucked.
So fucked. Oh my god.
For sure, what one thing that is being referenced here is the woman who I'm gonna link to this actual article, but the woman played by Mikkel Brown, who plays the magical executioner who participates in Tina's attempted execution. We are not the authorities on this, but I think, just in case people are for whatever reason not familiar with this history, because I know we have listeners from all over, and that people are not always aware of history. That is a subject that many people are weak on. There is a very long history, particularly in North America, during both slavery and the era of Jim Crow law, when black people were frequently killed by mobs of white people without trials. And so there's, again, I have absolutely no interest in questions of intentionality with the casting. I think that it is the most generous possible reading is that it is a horrifying level of laziness and ignorance being modeled for us. And the more likely reading is that it is a sort of linking of blackness to non-trial executions that is really insidious, and in a movie with so few black characters is particularly horrific. We glossed the sort of briefly in the last episode, we glossed the absence of black characters. But when we actually start to think more about who those characters are and the roles that they play, it becomes even more horrifying. So the other question that we got on this is from Arden herself who asks, what did you think of the sexualized black goblin lady in the bar and the implications of goblin races? So that's the other role that we see black women playing in this movie, is that we get the revelation that apparently goblins can have races, which we were not aware of because goblins have been used as metaphors for race thus far, and that we are encouraged to read that goblin as black in a way that is parallel to human blackness by positioning her as a sexualized lounge singer character. And that's both fucked up and profoundly confusing. So, yeah, if you are not somebody who is already painfully aware due to your own positioning of both the dearth and the violence of representations of black women in cinema, use this opportunity to read more widely about this. We will again, it's starting to sound like we're putting together a reading list for this episode, mm-hmm. Which I think can't hurt. But if this is not something you have already been thinking about a lot and are not already aware of, I really encourage you to pay more attention to it and to think in really careful ways when you watch movies about the way that cinema represents black women. Because it's, guys, it's almost always this bad. It's real fucked up.
Katie A. Robinson asks, I'd also love to hear your thoughts on Narlak's deformity, a result of his being half goblin, half human, I think. So for anybody who is as confused as I was, Narlak is the goblin man who owns the Blind Pig, which is the bar that they go, and he's the horrible person who tries to take Newt's bow truckle and left us all in tears. So I don't know enough about why his fingers are bent back or how that might be related to his being part goblin. I didn't actually realize that he was part goblin. I just assumed that he was full goblin, but just like a different like size and breadth of goblin. I don't know.
Which he might be.
He might very well be. But one thing I think that we can say with confidence is that this is another example of this series using deformity and like disability as a way of signifying villainy or deviation from goodness, right? Yeah. So we can very confidently say it's not okay for your only visibly disabled character to be a shitty person.
Yeah.
That's not a good way of including diversity of ability in your story. That's, I would say, fucked up, which is the new... Yeah. The new subtitle of this episode. Yeah. It's fucked up.
It's real fucked up. This just occurred to me. It's not a direct answer to this question, but we've had conversations in the past about the way in which non-normatively bodied people are used as human special effects. And this movie has instead CGI'd everyone. So there's no use of little people as house elf or goblin proxies. And yet, despite that choice to CGI everyone instead, the movie continues to trade on the equation of disability and different bodies as a signifier of people's moral characters. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, you did away with this one thing, but just made sure to keep reminding us that if someone looks weird, they're probably bad. Mm-hmm. This is another slight tangent, but I praised the animal rights ethos of the movie in our last episode, and I stand by that. But animal rights is a politics that white people particularly enjoy and that white people often use as a way to evade questions of racism. And it is notable that our white protagonist, Newt, brings us into this world of a great deal of compassion for beasts. But in that world, humanoid non-humans are still treated with exactly the same level of hatred, disregard, bigotry, etc. Even while we are being encouraged to see these beasts as not monstrous.
Which please, make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know, oh, oh, Witch, please, make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know.
Topic 5. Other? Student of Whim wants to know, Neil, given that Fantastic Beasts is a Scooby-Doo story, which creature is Scooby-Doo?
I think you can probably guess what creature I want to be, Scooby. It's entirely unwarranted by this.
I mean, I believe what he is referencing is the fact that our protagonists, our sort of erstwhile scrappy gang of protagonists, spend this movie chasing down what they believe to be one villain, only to, in the final scene, pull a comical mask off his head and realize that it was actually Old Man Struthers of the Jam Factory the whole time, and he would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for those meddling kids.
I also just realized that the bad guy turns out to be the first character we saw in the entire movie, and the first name that we saw.
Yeah.
But that is a real Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, one of the questions somebody asked that I didn't end up including was, what do you make of the fact that the movie like aggressively foreshadows that it's going to be Grindelwald? And I was like, I don't like that question because I didn't get it. So many people are being like, oh, so obvious it was Grindelwald. And I'm like, you all need to shut up. I didn't know.
I did the same thing. Anytime anybody, even including a dear friend of mine who was like, it was obviously Grindelwald. I knew it was him at the beginning. I was like, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. You're just retconning. You had no idea.
People are so, this reminds me of a discussion right now about Rogue One with Star Wars. Yeah. Where there's a character in it who's entirely CGI. And
there's two.
Yeah, one of them is more, you know, prominent. But I really hate that people on Twitter are like, oh my god, like anyone who couldn't tell that or wasn't aware of that must be like blind or something. It's like, or you don't know that particular actor is dead, yeah. Or you're just not looking for that to happen, or like there's any number of explanations for it.
I was one of those people who didn't know, so screw all of you.
Fuck you.
Well, it's also, I don't know who, like, what is the purpose of watching a science fiction or fantasy movie and being like, that's not real. Like, what is wrong with you? Scooby, though, Scooby, the bow truckle is Scooby. I think that's the only creature that makes sense here. The sidekick character who kind of is plot relevant. I mean, not as active as Scooby-Doo, but Scooby-Doo just ran from stuff anyway. Like, he just blundered into things. I mean, in a lot of ways, the bow truckle is a more inspiring figure. The point of Scooby-Doo isn't to inspire you, the audience. I don't think. Like, the character of Scooby-Doo. My take on it is that it's the bow truckle. What do you two think?
I'm more interested in you breaking down all of the other characters into their Scooby-Doo.
Oh, this is gonna be good. Okay. Okay, so Daphne is obviously Queenie.
Okay.
That seems indisputable. Mm-hmm. I would say that Newt is Shaggy. Okay. Jacob, well, Jacob isn't really much of a Fred. Seems kind of hard. I mean, you could, like, the gender thing.
Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, okay, Jacob can be Velma. But I feel like in Scooby-Doo, there isn't really a character who's noticeably more clueless than the others, with the exception of Scooby. Is Jacob a Scooby?
Mm.
Oh my god. Yeah. Oh no,
so
this is complicated. Wow.
I wish I was more familiar with Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
I'm not. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Instead, you can tell us what each of the characters from this movie, what their equivalent is in
Steampunk?
Buffy. The
Steampunk!
Candidate Scooby-Doo.
Neil had forgotten about Steampug. I'm not, you, none of you have earned Steampug yet.
Thanks, dear listeners, for joining us for episode 18B of Witch Please. The rest of our episodes are always available at owitchplease.ca or wherever you download podcasts. Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. Special thanks to Freelance Love, Filthy Rat Baby, wow, and Abigail in the World for your lovely reviews. We're currently struggling to figure out how to access reviews on the international iTunes, but we have it on good authority that Indigo Hen, Leticiando, Grebditch, and A Case for Books have left us international reviews, and for that, we are eternally grateful. Also, please let us know how to pronounce your handles if we did it badly, as I probably did. Shoutouts also to the Purple Coffee, Grebditch again, and Noranosaurus for posting sweet shots of yourselves with our glorious merch, which is available at society6.com/ohwitchplease. And mega thanks to Becca Likes Books, who sent us a beautiful and delightful knit pair of Hedwigs in the mail. We love them. You don't even know how much we love them. We love them so much.
So we've been hearing from a number of you about your disappointment about missing out on the Twitter list due to the long hiatus between canonical episodes. We're not going to start doing it again. I tracked the number of people who tweeted at us between the last episode and this one, and there's 303 unique Twitter IDs. It's, friends, it is too much. But we are going to keep working on coming up with other ways that we can get in touch with you and you can get in touch with us and we can include you in our episodes. So stay tuned about some possible exciting new ventures in that direction. I also want to give you all a heads up that we are in the process of working out ways to make our podcast more accessible through creating either transcriptions or captioned videos of our existing episodes. So please also stay tuned for more information about that.
Can you imagine if we videotaped ourselves recording these episodes?
Disgusting.
There are literally chips all over my face right now. I've just got a face mask of chips.
So good for your pores.
So good for my pores. Huge thanks to our wonderful friend Todd, also known as Toby B, for writing this special new theme song for Fantastic Asks.
Which please, make it make sense to me. Because a muggle in me just wants to know.
And special thanks, as always, to Trevor Chow Fraser, our erstwhile tech support and the robot of our hearts.
Hi, how are you doing?
We'll be back with more of those minisodes you know and love. But until then...
Later, witches.